Hello, I'm Andy Hopper, and Shai has asked me just to say a few words of background and tee up my pal here about UbiSense. So, actually, I notice, Shai, from your list for this term and next term, that I think I'm the only full-time, normal, standard jobbing academic. And I've given many lectures in this place to this lecture theatre. So, that's my thing. And one of the wonderful things about Cambridge University is that you have relatively few restrictions, and so I've simultaneously done an industrial thing, simultaneously at the same time. So, you know, you do your academic, you give a lecture, bring something up, write a paper, drink some port, you're happy. And on the industrial side, you think, well, who would buy something? What's something that could be constructed that could be bought? Now, in order to answer the second question, you've got to the topics are mindset and motivation. So let me just explain a little bit of the mindset. So my basic mindset is, or model, if you like, is research student becomes business partner, and an equal, essentially, business partner. Okay, so if you go back, so you know, research students come along. I've done 50 now, so you know, I remember them all dearly. And after 3 years of engagement, if you wish to become partners in something, you know, you don't really know each other. So that tends to mean it lasts, and actually, it's lasted in each case forever because it just carries on. So that's a kind of a model. And then other thing is the university provides a wonderful broad perspective to make your decision. So I don't have a patent to my name, right? I don't do patents. That's not what it's all about. In the foreground, in the background they're important, but in the foreground, in that early stage, it's not about, oh, I've got a patent and you know, therefore I'll get impact. It's what's happening in the academic world, what's happening in the financial world, what are the skills of us, me and my future partner, what's the team we can put together, what are the startups doing, what sort of capital is available, does it grow on dollar trees or yen trees or pound trees, or does it not grow anything at all, what's the perspective on funding over 3 or 5 years, in other words, what's the exit, work back from that, all that sort of stuff. Now, if you have all that available and you've got the 3 or 4 year engagement doing a PhD, and the topic almost doesn't matter because essentially none of the things came directly out of a PhD. Again, life isn't as formulaic as that. You're onto a winner, and you know, some of my things have done that. So I hope that gives you a little illustration of how it's worked for me, and some of you will do very well, no doubt, and those that are millionaires remember us in Cambridge University. Now, the particular story you'll hear today, again, just give you a little bit of background, is about location technology applications, in other words, systems which provide location like GPS, and then what can you do with that? So let first of all tell you how this started. And it started in 1988, before you were mostly born, right? And it's been so slow, I'm going to fall asleep. Technology has moved super slow, right? Super slow. We moved into a rather large building, having been in a small building and with a group of about 5 or 6 of us. And we were in a much bigger building, and we couldn't find each other, having moved from a place where we could see each other. So a fella came into my office, had just finished his PhD, and said, oh, I employed him. What should we do? I said, design a system that finds people. Oh, not quite on a whim. I actually was using GPS outside some of the early systems that were available from the military. I said, oh, okay. And off he went. So that was 1988. Now, since I do have an academic background, you'll forgive me, a component to my life, that essentially my most cited paper is on this stuff. If you read it today, it's still got most of the ideas in it. 3,000 citations, and it's a 1990 paper, 21 years ago. Okay, and so you can still read down and say, well, this is going to happen next. It does take a while, and timing is very important. Anyway, those location systems came and went in various prototype forms. We built various systems. Generations of my and other people, PhD students, got their PhDs around this sort of area, indoor location technology and applications. Finally, and you'll hear from my pal Richard here, how the specific thing called UbiSense as a company, it's now quite a successful business, I would suggest, happened. But it's in the context that there was a pool of people we could, with the property, like my partners and all that, that's for sure. But also beyond that, a whole bunch of people we are employing now, and actually some of our competitors are employing, that have the knowledge, like the taxi driver, have the knowledge about this whole space, both technologically and all this other stuff I mentioned, which I think is a very important component to the success which we are having, long may it continue. So I hope you find that background of some interest. It tries to answer Shai's headline for this session about mindset and motivation. I guess the final comment about motivation, that's just about personalities and what interests you. So I like practical things, so it ends up being useful in a direct way. So, you can't have a theoretical doctor, you can only have a really practical doctor. Well, so that was the motivation, but the mindset I hope I explain in some detail. So let me now ask Richard, who is the CEO and the total focal point of our business, to carry on with a little bit more of where the specific UbiSense story started, and on from there.
Great, thanks, Andy. Is that loud enough? Can everybody hear me? Okay. So we've got a script and we've got some slides that I'm not going to use either, because I think the net output of this session, I think, is for you to go away learning something about my particular journey and why I'm here today, and hopefully take away one key message for me, and that is this stuff can really be a lot of fun. If you get lucky, you can make a lot of money. But then two aren't necessarily related. I came to Cambridge back in 1983, and met a bunch of guys in a startup who said that they were all about having fun and making money. Here am I, how many years later? 28 years later, is it? 28 years later, and I'm still doing it. So either I'm pretty poor at it, or I haven't made enough money, or I'm having a lot of fun. Nah. So and I think the fun thing is really important. And I think my children still question me now. A business that we sold back in 2000, I could have ended up with a really secure job in a very large corporation, with none of the risks associated with a startup, which I'll talk about. And they really question why I gave up that job and started all over again. And I think getting up in the morning and having a lot of fun is really quite important. When we go through the UbiSense story, there's some slides here. What is this? Yeah, there are lots and lots of startup stories, I guess, about people making a lot of money in a very short period of time. But as Andy said, these things always take an awful lot longer than you think. Here's one thing that sticks out in my mind as well. Some of you would already know all about this, and that's You know, being your own boss, one of those characteristics I think that Shai put up on the slides earlier were all to do with you're not taking no as an answer. And that's quite important to a lot of folks. And being your own boss is one way of achieving that objective, of course. So this is Paul's slide, I think. So Paul was one of Andy's team that I had the good fortune to come across back in 2002. the years before that were all to do with a couple of startups, one of which I co-founded in 1988, which was all to do with taking maps and putting them into a computer system so that you could figure out where the electricity cables and telephone wires were in the street. Of course, we'd all go out and use Google Maps now, but in 1988, Google wasn't around. PCs were pretty primitive, and so the idea that you could take a piece of paper and scan it and put it into a computer and turn it into a map you could display on the screen was pretty advanced technology. And we turned that business into a fairly significant Cambridge company. We took it to NASDAQ in 1996, the American Stock Exchange, because the London Stock Exchange didn't recognize technology companies back in the mid-90s. And we eventually sold that to General Electric Corporation in 2000. After a couple of years with General Electric, didn't quite feel like an individual working for one of the world's largest corporations, and certainly wasn't in control of my own destiny. So met Andy's team that were looking for some funding and some help. And so having done it once, rather stupidly, I looked at doing it all over again. Perhaps this time, putting a little bit of money in and some effort and turning it into a lot more money. And so, as Andy said, quite a lot of the technology had already been prototyped and developed in the lab, and the guys really seemed to have worked through many of the issues. And when I first met them, it was pretty clear that they were a pretty passionate bunch, and they were going to make things happen. And that was really the inspiration to pull together a group of colleagues and invest in this small group of guys out of Andy's lab, who convinced me that people would be wanting to have GPS indoors. I didn't even know that GPS didn't work indoors until I met this group. And of course it doesn't, because you can't see satellites. And so the idea that you would want to track things indoors really rather appealed to somebody who'd had the last 10 or 12 years messing around with maps. Of course, just going through these slides of Paul's then, the first thing we did was look at the name. The guys had called themselves Ubiquitous Systems, which seemed a bit of a mouthful. Probably wasn't going to work too well in the German market. So we thought we'd try and trim the name down a bit, and we called it UbiSense. The guys were sitting in an office in Mount Pleasant, which I think was Herman Hauser's office at the time, and we're trying to get to grips with what the market for this stuff was going to be. Of course, it's an early stage market. There isn't a whole bunch of market research out there to tell you where the market is. And so, the first thing to do is try and find, a category that you're going to sell into. Now, for a venture capital-backed company, that's pretty important. They're mainly looking at businesses that have an established market. These guys couldn't even find a piece of research that said that the market was going to be 100 million or a billion. So it was a fairly risky proposition, one which traditionally VCs wouldn't get behind. I guess it was that opportunity presented itself to me and my colleagues to get in at a very early stage connection. We've been looking at lots of location-based opportunities in the belief that we could take some of the experience that we'd had before and apply it to some new ideas. So those two groups came together, and we started the company and started trading at the beginning of 2003. And again, this is one of Paul's slides, but it's so characteristic of any startup, and it's really a roller coaster. So the ups and downs, as witnessed by one of the founders, that we get out of the lab all fired up, getting together with his mates, forming a team, going into a situation where they got some money, and then the demotivation that goes with actually not closing a deal, coming out of that, getting to know some folks that were convinced that they put some money in, then getting some technology demonstrators working, getting all fired up about that, getting to the point where you can actually raise funding to take the idea and take it to market. But then, of course, if you're going to share the idea with somebody who's going to put some money in, you're going to have to accept some dilution, which can be a bit of a demotivator too. Then it all picks up again as you get the first customer and get some revenue. And it continues this cycle even to this day. Once you've gone through the stage of getting prototypes out, getting the first sales out, then you realize that to expand the business, you've got to go and get some more money and take even more dilution. And so the roller coaster continues. And that just doesn't affect the team and the employees, it's all the others around them too. So, quick journey through that in a more linear fashion. So, from those early days and prototypes, the scary stage of exploring the market. There weren't a, wasn't a row of customers standing outside the office once the prototype had been produced. It was a matter of finding out who was going to be crazy enough to buy this very early stage product. Luckily, there was a whole bunch of labs like Andy's lab around the world that were looking to research this area, so we got a lot of researchers just on the name and reputation of the lab here. And that in itself led us into places like Intel and Cisco. In fact, there was one very high moment in the history of the company in 2007, I think, where we were convinced that Cisco was going to adopt this technology across all their offices throughout the world. We thought we were made. That was it. Finished. Game over. 5 years into this venture, we were going to sell out to Cisco and we'd finished. Didn't quite turn out like that. And the amount of time and effort and flights we had over to San Jose, San Jose to Building 14 were unbelievable. And then IBM came along with a whole rack of safety applications, and we were convinced that IBM was going to take us to market. We installed systems, I think, around 20, 25 offices around the world, and we're still here, a 25, 30-man company. So the reach that we could see from IBM was fantastic. Again, it didn't quite turn out to be as good as it looked. But then we had a real breakthrough in 2008. We had a German team that got lucky and were contracted by BMW in their Regensburg plant to solve a really quite difficult location problem inside the car plant that had a lot of problems matching how a torque tool that's used to tighten up bolts on safety-critical components like seat belts, to do that reliably and repeatedly across different models of a car. And they looked at automating that process and contracted us to have a go. And it turned out that it worked reasonably well enough for BMW to come back and give us a contract. We then turned that into a major activity in the automotive industry, such that in 2009, a company you've probably never heard of, the world's largest industrial tool manufacturer, Atlas Copco, came along and said, we'd like to take the technology and embed it in all our tools that we're going to sell around the world. So that was a lucky break. It sounded, again, as if we were made. It was, it was all going to happen. Here we are, 2.5 years later, still working out how to get that relationship going and how we're going to sell tools into all their customers with our equipment in it. So in 2010, we thought it was time to go and raise a bit more money. The stock market was looking a little shaky, so we went out and did something called a pre-IPO fundraise. At the same time, won our first large transit authority, which again was a market that we hadn't really spotted way back when. The fact that a city of Chicago would lose one of its 2,000 buses sound inconceivable, but they actually needed to track where the buses were in their depots so that they could schedule them and dispatch them and so on. Quite a large problem that we stumbled across and have turned that into a major market. So earlier this year, we thought the company was ready to take the next stage. We took it to the AIM market on the London Stock Exchange to raise money to take it to the next level. So we went and raised just north of £8 million. And since then, have already made two small acquisitions. So the headcount of the company is something like 175 people, which is a lot of people to pay. We have to sell a lot of systems to do that. And from this point on, we've found a market, we've got some cash behind us. The textbooks will tell you it's all about execution. You've just got to keep doing the same thing over and over again. Of course, that assumes that the world doesn't change and you don't get competition and so on and so on. So that's the next challenge of growth of the business. Motivation was the theme of the talk. It's pretty important. The business is all about the team that came out of Andy's lab, the team that we put together to invest in the company, the team we put together to manage and grow the company, to sell the systems, and so on. So the technology has a huge role to play, but it's not the most important facet of the business. It's the people that make the business. You have to work really hard to make sure that they're going to come back in tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day. So back to my original thought, and that is, they need to get up in the morning and think they're going to have fun. Because otherwise, they're probably going to walk out of the office one evening and not come back the next day. So, the team is really quite key and important. And the team is not just the technical founders, it's the management team, it's the board, Andy and the rest of our colleagues who bring a huge mix of skills and experience to bear, and the investor community as well. People who recycle some of the skills and money that they've made earlier in their careers can bring quite a lot to a small startup business. And as you heard from both Shai and Andy earlier, there's a very active angel community here in Cambridge. People are very willing to get involved and support new businesses. There's a whole bunch of other companies that I know nothing about that Paul and Andy and so on have spun out of that same embryonic lab. I think all various degrees of maturity. Now you'd expect a technical founder to say this, wouldn't you? High-tech startups are hard work. But it's really great when you can be the best. And that's all to do with your baby and being passionate about it. You know, that's such a solid foundation for any startup. And the example here is another company that began a couple of years before we did, over in the US in Huntsville, Alabama, and they had $160 million worth of funding. In fact, the company closed down last year. Compared to us, we've had something like a 20th of the funding. And as I said earlier, we've grown the company to about 175 employees. So it's not about the money. You know, the money has a role to play. It's, you know, more to do with you know, the people and their motivation and you know, the drive they have to make this work. And so far, I think when this slide was put together, Paul would have counted 350 installations. I think we're well over 500 fairly serious installations with, you know, global customers like Airbus. We track the Airbus A380 across 7, 8, 9, 10 of their manufacturing plants now, as they're being built in San Jose and Toulouse and Hamburg and Broughton and Filton. We track each of those major component assemblies as they build one large aircraft. So it's a huge customer for us, as is BMW. This is a slide that is completely baffling to me. This is Paul's one of the hardware team. And obviously, he's, you know, continues to strive to make it faster and cheaper and better and smaller. So that was the theme of that slide. And of course, you know, there is competition. If there's a market, there's bound to be competition. And it's really important, you know, to keep a watchful eye on the competition. But my analogy, one of the things I discovered rather late in life was motor racing. And the analogy I always talk about with the team, thinking about the competition, is the relationship between the windscreen and the rearview mirror. You've got to really keep things in perspective. Look in the rearview mirror occasionally because there's going to be some competition behind you, but the real focus should be what's in front of you through the windscreen. Dealing with demotivation, well, this is a slide you really don't want to be taking away because startups really do always take twice as long and cost twice as much, but you don't want to believe that and hear that when you start your own business. So, but that's just a reality that you forget fairly quickly once you get into these things. Dilution, unfortunately, it's one of the consequences of wanting to grow. And the analogy is, you know, if you really want to make the pie bigger, you've got to accept, you know, other contributors to the pie, and you're going to have to accept, you know, a smaller slice of a much bigger pie. Not everybody will be as motivated as the individuals that start the business, and the team has to really strive to make that. So, and it always goes to plan. So this was Paul's thoughts. Recommended if you want to learn new skills and experiences, you thrive on challenges. And what I'd add to that is if you want to have some fun, and if you get really lucky, you can also make some money.